So welcome to Paradigm Shifters. We have a very fun and deep, so that's a good combination, isn't it? Student of Buddhism, who's a Zen master and used to be a punk rocker, which I suppose everybody says in every interview you have. And his latest book is Don't Be a Jerk. Welcome to the show, Brad Warner. What kind of a title is that?
Don't be a jerk. It's, the book is a kind of a mistranslation, sort of a new translation or a new, what am I calling it? Not translation. What's the other word? Paraphrasing.
Okay.
Of a very old Japanese Zen classic called Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. And it's a collection of essays by a guy named Dogen. And one of the essays is called in Japanese Shōwaku Makusa, which means something like do not enact wrong. And in my paraphrasing, I decided that a good way to say the same thing in contemporary English was don't be a jerk. And that,
well, it's like the Ten Commandments squeezed into a thumbnail, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I think. I think that's exactly it, because that's kind of what Dogen is saying in that particular essay. And he says it throughout Shobogenzo, throughout the book. He says that the main point of Buddhism and the main teaching of Buddhism is don't enact wrong or don't be a jerk. So it's kind of, like you say, it's the Ten Commandments and the Ten Buddhist Precepts, which are kind of similar to the Ten Commandments, all kind of end up saying the same thing.
I like that because, in all the plethora of spiritual roots, I really like to know there are these foundational spiritual principles and disciplines for us all. How did you get into Zen? And, tell me this. What exactly is Zazen versus Zen? Maybe you should define some terms. Let's do a glossary.
Okay, sure. Zazen is the meditation practice we do, and as you may have noticed, I sort of hesitated before I said the word meditation. It's because I don't really know if meditation is the proper word for it, because Zazen seems to be something quite different from what most people think of as meditation, in that outwardly it looks like the same thing. You're sitting on a cushion, you've got your legs crossed, and you're sitting up straight. The only sort of obvious difference in Zazen is that you usually keep your eyes open in Zazen rather than closed. But
why is that?
Well, it kind of goes along with the way that it's different, because we are acknowledging the outside world as part of our practice. So we're not trying to engage in some kind of introspection exactly. I mean, introspection might happen during Zazen, but it's not the point of the practice. So you're not trying to close out the outside world and get into your own internal thing. You're actually accepting the outside world, but you're facing a wall normally. There's another time where you're facing outward into the room, but even then you're looking at the floor and not really at the people in the room. So you're looking at something, and the biggest difference between it and sort of what most people think of as meditation is that there's no goal to it. And this is really the hardest part for people to get, I think, because it was the hardest part for me to get, and I'm still working on it years, after 30-some years of doing this practice, where I have to constantly remind myself that there is no goal to this practice. I'm not trying to make something happen.
Well, this reminds me of a question I wanted to ask you to explain to people. What a Zen koan is, because I think that's embedded in what you're saying right now, is it not?
Well, it might be. Koans, when people usually use that word, they're referring to those kind of funny questions that Zen teachers will sometimes use, like what is the sound of one hand clapping, and if a tree falls in the forest and hits a mime, does the mime make a sound or something, one of these kind of goofy questions. Those are used mainly, well, they're used both in both sorts of Zen. There's two sorts of Zen. There's Rinzai and Soto. And the Rinzai Zen, which tends to be the thing that people hear a lot about in TV shows and movies and things, in that form of Zen, they'll use those as questions. They'll actually assign each student one of these questions, and they're supposed to meditate on it and supposed to present their teacher with an answer to it.
Mm.
In the Soto style, which is what I studied, they also use the koans, but they don't assign them to a student as a practice thing. They're just usually something your teacher talks about and presents to you in maybe a lecture or often in books.
Well, why I brought us into that discussion right now is a line that I underlined, which said things, and this is what you wrote, things are often one way and another at the same time. So that might not be the right thing for me to hold on to, but I really liked it. I went, oh, that's a real study in my thinking to be able to do that.
That's from I think I wrote that in the chapter on Genjo Koan, which is one of Dogen's writings. And one of the problems with Dogen that makes him so difficult for translators is that he's contradictory. And in the West, there's a very strong philosophical tradition that goes all the way back to, I don't know, either Plato or Socrates, which says that contradictions are more or less forbidden. Like something can't be both one thing and its opposite at the same time.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think Plato even says that in one of his, one of his foundational ideas. But Dogen never heard of Plato, for one thing, because he was Japanese in a time when they didn't have access to that. But he just goes completely against that anyway. He actually will tell you things are one thing and they're opposite at the same time.
Oh, I took it as holding a big picture of the dualities that we're accustomed to looking at.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's it. You're always kind of faced with these dualities. You're happy and sad at the same time. You know, things are never black and white. You know, I think it's just a truth about things. The problem is when you're expressing things verbally, you have to make a choice. You have to say one thing or the other. But it doesn't mean that's the nature of reality. That's just the nature of how you can speak about reality.
Well, I want to know who you are, and I'm sure our listeners do, and how you... I think that if I remember correctly, you were a musician, you're a character, you're a Western kind of a guy. How did you get involved in the Zen practice? And you've certainly been diligent about that, have you not?
I guess I've been diligent. I got into it when I was in my late teens, and I'm not really sure of the year, but I was at Kent State University in Ohio, which is where I mostly grew up, except for a stint in Africa when I was a child, which is a whole other story. But
Kent State, was that when all that drama was going on and the shooting and all that?
Kent State, it was about 10 years, more than about 12 years after all that stuff happened. That stuff was in 1970, but it was still a big thing on campus, and everybody knew about it, and you heard about it. And the dorm I lived in was the dorm. There's a famous film of the event actually happening, and it was shot from maybe not the exact room that I lived in, but the same building where I lived, which I found interesting because it was the view out my window.
Oh, wow, really? Well, that would be touching, even though it wasn't the same time. So you keep going about who you are. Fascinating man you are.
Yeah, so I was a bass player in a punk band called Zero Defects, which reformed about 10 years ago, and we still play sometimes. So I'm still doing that in a way, even though it wasn't continuous from that period. And I just, the reason I got into punk rock was because I liked the music, for one thing, but also because I was looking for a kind of truth that I thought was expressed in the musically in the punk scene, maybe not always and maybe not consistently, but we were trying to do something that was more real than what the rest of the rock scene was offering at the time.
Is that through lyrics and so on?
Lyrics and musically, and just kind of, it felt like rock music at the time was, you know, this is way before Nirvana or any of those things happened, and it just felt very plastic and like people were, you know, they were in bands just to become popular and sell records, and there was nothing there was nothing really being expressed there. It was like listening to commercials. I thought, you know, when I listened to the radio, I thought, well, you know, I might as well just be listening to commercials for bands. You know, these aren't real songs anymore. So I don't know. I got into it because of that. And when I discovered Zen, I thought that it was the most punk rock thing I'd ever encountered. That's what I always say to people when telling them this story. And that's because it took the same attitude as I found in punk, which was trying to get at the real truth and the real heart of things. But it seemed to take it a lot further than punk rock did, because it was kind of, it wasn't just questioning society and questioning the status quo. It was also questioning yourself and your own existence and who am I really? So I just really fell right in love with it and kept doing the practice for years and years.
Did you do the practice in the U.S. or did you go off to Japan right away?
I didn't go off to Japan right away. I had a teacher, an American teacher, for about the first 10 years, and I had no ideas about becoming a teacher of Zen. I just was a person who practiced it, and I really didn't even tell most of my friends about it. I just kind of did it.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Japan in 1993, and not to pursue Zen, but because I was broken out of work, and I found a job over there as an English teacher. And I was interested in Japan, and Zen was part of that interest. But I was more, in terms of Japanese culture, I was much more interested in Godzilla than Zen. You know, I mean, that's why I wanted to go to Japan. You know, so I went over there, and I
to work on Godzilla.
What was that?
I said to be Godzilla or to work on Godzilla?
Well, to both. You know, I ended up working not on Godzilla directly, but there's a company called Tsuburaya Productions, which was established by the guy who pretty much invented Godzilla. Godzilla geeks will dispute this, but basically he's the guy who put the original movie together. You know, one of the main people, and he went off and formed his own company, and I ended up working for that company. And basically, what we did was make kind of miniature Godzilla movies for television. I mean, that's a very short version of what we did. But
was it fun?
Oh, it was great! It was great because, you know, there was, I was friends with the guys who put on those rubber suits and went and stomped on all those little miniature buildings and toy cars and stuff. And I lived a couple of blocks from the studio where they did that. So on weekends, I'd just walk over there and, you know, stand around all day watching them do that.
Wow. And did you go off and do your practice as well? I mean, you must have found a good master in Japan.
Yeah, I did. I found a teacher named Nishijima, and he's dead now, but he was at the time one of the few people who was teaching Zen in English for non-Japanese speaking people. He had a kind of an idea that Zen in Japan was more or less dead, and he wanted to kind of keep it alive, and he thought that teaching in English was the way to do that. So I started going to his classes on Saturday afternoons, and eventually he asked me to ordain in his Buddhist order, which was not something I really wanted to do. That wasn't what I got into it for, but he kind of talked me into ordaining, and that's how I, you know, became, I don't really like the phrase Zen master, but it's one of those things you're kind of stuck with because everybody else uses it. So, you know, I don't think it's an accurate term. It sort of implies something, some kind of mastery, which is ultimately impossible.
Well, I have a lot to say about that, but I want to go back to Dogen. He was like the top guy from the 12th century. Is that right? And did I read correctly that his work kind of lapsed and people weren't paying attention to it, and then it had a resurgence?
Yeah, basically, I don't know that in his lifetime, I don't feel like Dogen was very influential or well-known. He went to China to study Buddhism over there and came back having been ordained by a Chinese master, and he established a temple in that teacher's lineage, not really knowing whether it would pick up or turn into anything. But he, what's interesting about him, or what makes him worth studying, is because he was also a writer, you know, a writer in the truly modern sense of what it means to be a writer. He would, and so he wrote a lot of material about this practice and what he'd learned in China, you know, a huge amount of it. And
it was like lectures. It wasn't the stuff that he wrote, like lectures for people or teachings?
Some of it was lectures. Some of it seems to be written just to be, you know, read as a written piece rather than as a lecture. They're often, the title Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, Shobo Genzo, is a title he gave to a bunch of his pieces. He would give them that title and then a subtitle. So that's why they've been grouped together in one thing. So he apparently intended it as a large single piece of writing, but he died before he could finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And the what happened is the temple that he founded produced a lot of offshoot temples and became really popular. That organization that developed in the intervening hundreds of years after his death became very strong. It's almost like a Japanese version of the Vatican in a way. But his writing was kind of forgotten along the line, you know, as time went by. And in fact, the organization that developed after his death actually at one point forbid anybody from producing and reprinting any of Dogen's writings.
And why would that be?
Well, the parallels with the Vatican are pretty strong there, too. This is kind of a similar thing to what the Catholic Church did in the Middle Ages, where they wanted to have a monopoly on the Bible. So the Soto Shu, I think probably taking a cue from what they were learning about Europe at the time, decided that this is the organization that developed after Dogen's death. They decided they wanted to have a monopoly. And honestly, I think the reason is because the higher-ups in the organization themselves didn't understand Shobo Genzo, and they didn't want the embarrassment of people asking them to explain it.
That's interesting. Well, I don't know what's mean, because I think rules and dogma come up in that kind of way, that people, you know, try to control it or try to give people controls or whatever, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a perennial human story. People seek to. I think it's happening in the U.S. right now, but that's a whole other topic. And it's sort of a minor movement. But there are organizations in America that are emerging which would like to kind of control what is Zen Buddhism in America, and I'm not really in favor of that sort of thing.
Well, let's go back to Dogen. What did he control? Like, how doctrinary did he ever get? It doesn't seem, from what I've read, is that he was affixed in doctrine and dogma at all.
Well, no, it depends on how you define it. He was pretty strict as a person who believed in the discipline. Zen is a very disciplined sort of practice, especially if you do it in a monastery, which Dogen oversaw a monastery. So in that sense, he was.
And it was for men
dogmatic.
Only? Oh, okay.
Yeah. At the time, although Dogen was pretty fiercely championing the inclusion of women, although it was probably not the time and place to actually open up a coeducational monastery, but he was, even though he didn't go that far, he was very strong in his belief that both women and men were equally capable of doing this practice, and he really fiercely denounced, there was a large amount of people who said otherwise in his day, and he was very strongly against that, which may also account for part of the reason that the Soto Shu, the organization, didn't want Dogen's writings to be promulgated because they were kind of not following Dogen's original philosophy.
Well, can you talk a little bit about what the attitude is to women? Were they afraid of, for example, some of what I read made me think that perhaps celibacy was a way for men to not lose their focus and attention. Is that it? It's not some what I read, and you can correct me, but it was more, it seemed more like men get distracted by the feminine, and that's more important to think about than being co-educational. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, that's where it stems from. So Buddha himself was maybe not the first, but one of the earliest Indian spiritual teachers to allow women to become part of his tradition, and to, you know, to have full status within that tradition. But he also established separate monasteries for women and for men, and both women and men who were doing monastic Buddhist practice were supposed to be celibate. Mm-hmm. Now, Buddha didn't advise celibacy for general population. It was just part of the monastic training was a vow of celibacy. And what happened after Buddha died was that men who were trying to help other men deal with this vow of celibacy were kind of doing what you were saying. They were seeing women, who represented to them sex as a distraction from their one-pointed practice. So there developed this strong, almost misogynistic tint to certain kinds of Buddhism, which unfortunately remains today.
Oh, it
but
does, eh?
In a lot of Southeast Asia especially. But I don't think it was initially intended to be misogynistic. It was intended to kind of help male monastics, and I don't think it's a really healthy way to help them, but by presenting, you know, women as this kind of evil, it was supposed to help them to get away from their cravings for sex.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of weird stuff happened because I wrote a whole other book about sex and Buddhism, in which I got into this idea that there's sort of if you read certain Buddhist texts out of context, they sound a bit anti-homosexual too, but that's because the thing of hating women sort of turned into, people would get confused. They would think, we can have sex, just not sex with women. So the men were having sex with each other, and so then you have monastic regulations forbidding that,
mm-hmm.
which, taken out of context, sound like, you know, anti-homosexual kind of stuff. But
well, this is really this is very interesting because this is crux and core stuff for all spiritual traditions these days, isn't it? You know,
yeah, I think so. I think a lot of it's. I'm not one of those who believes that all spiritual traditions are ultimately the same, because I think there's some important differences from tradition to tradition,
mm-hmm.
but there are huge chunks of similarity that you can find in every spiritual tradition, and it's always fascinating to see how those come into play.
Yeah, I think so. Well, one of the things that you wrote about was the teacher who gave great service. But this is more current than back in the time of Buddha or the 12th century. But he was caught groping and abusing women, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he was living
yeah.
celibate. Well, we've heard a lot of stories like that in life, haven't we? And I liked the way, I thought it must be close to the philosophy, how you interpreted, talk about that, because I really appreciated how you put the interpretation.
Well, there have been a lot of these sort of scandals that have gone on where people have, as you say, they've been caught groping their students or doing these other often sexually inappropriate things, and it's made the news and all of that. And I think that happens. I mean, it obviously happens. We've got plenty of evidence. It doesn't necessarily necessarily mean that everything, the thing I kind of get concerned about is that'll happen, and then people want to throw at everything that teacher ever said. Now, if you weren't a fan of that teacher to begin with, there's probably no reason to follow some teacher who's been scandalized for doing that sort of thing. But if you were actually a person who learned things from that teacher, I think it's human nature. It's kind of this funny, fluid thing where you can be really profound in one area and be a total idiot in other areas of life, and it just happens. And we wish it wasn't that way, but sometimes it just is.
And well, so that's another thing you wrote about. You said just because you become a Buddha doesn't mean you stay that way. You have moments.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because we're saying the same thing. I just love the way you put that. This is a good book.
Yeah, yeah. I can't even remember exactly how I put it. But
well, it was something like what you're saying, only you said you can achieve Buddhahood, but you don't have to stay in there because most of us don't. You might have it for a few moments here and there, right?
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, there's a kind of myth that I'm glad to see it's dying out, but there was a kind of myth that once a person achieved something called enlightenment, either through Buddhism or often Hindu teachers would claim it as well, and different traditions do as well,
mm-hmm.
Then they were perfect. You know, that was like a finishing line after which they were perfect forever. And Dogen denounces that, and all the great spiritual teachers do, I think. It's something you have to work on. You might have a moment of great awakening, which will enable you to possibly be able to communicate something of that awakening to other people, and that's a great thing. But it doesn't turn you into a perfect person just because you've had a kind of a glimpse of perfection. You really have to work on it, and some people stop working on it, and that's a shame.
Well, it's interesting to me because I think in a way there's a compassion for humanity in that. Like, we do mess up. We do screw up. We do act like jerks, and put it in your language with the title of this book. We do act like jerks.
Everybody does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can slip out of it at any time, and it's kind of, you know, in Buddhist terms, there's this idea of karma, which I often shy away from using that word because it's so misunderstood, but you carry a lot of baggage, to use the contemporary term, with you. And just because you have an experience, a profoundly deep and spiritual experience, doesn't negate all of that baggage. It might put it into a different perspective, might give you a different understanding on it, but it doesn't make it go away.
But it can give you a discipline to wrangle with it. Is that true?
It might give you a discipline, but I almost feel discipline is maybe a separate thing. The discipline comes from being disciplined, and what you might see during a kind of a deeply spiritual experience is the reason for being disciplined, which one of the things that's pretty common to every spiritual tradition I know of is the understanding that we are all separate individuals, and that's true, but there's this ultimate sense in which we are all just one thing together with all humans and all animals and all planets and everything else. You know, it's just this one large sort of thing. And if you get a glimpse of that, you'll understand why it's important not to be a jerk to others, because there's really nobody else to be a jerk to. It's kind of stupid to do anything harmful to anybody else, because it doesn't help you at all. You know, that's an illusion. We mm-hmm. live in this kind of world where it's possible to have the illusion that if you steal from somebody, then you've got $10 and they don't, and yay for you. But really, the $10 belongs to the universe, and it didn't go anywhere. It just shifted 3 feet over to the left, and nobody gained anything, and nobody lost anything.
Right.
And you can have that understanding, but having that understanding and having the discipline to maintain it as a human being are sometimes very different things.
I think that's really fascinating. So one of the chapters I absolutely loved was Note to Self. There is no self. And I think this is a perfect time to be talking about the self. How is the self formed? What is the self? And can you talk a bit about that, and how do you experience all of that?
Well, it's a big question. One of the main ideas in Buddhism that trips everybody up is the idea of no self, and it's really a foundational idea in Buddhism. So it carries across every form of Buddhism, and people read that and they just go, "Well, that's absurd. I obviously have a self, you know." Like the only thing, there's a whole philosophy that says the only thing I know is that I am myself, and that's the problem isn't that all of the factors that we usually include under our heading of our definition of self, it's not that they don't exist. I have an individual experience of the world, and I have a history, and I have a name, and you know, all this stuff.
I have karma, right?
And I have karma, yeah.
The reason I said that is because we all come with like a patchwork quilt of influences and so on, do we not?
Yeah, sure, we do. We have all of that. You know, and that individual stuff is all there, but it's when you combine it into this idea of self is where the problem comes. You think that this self is something that it's not. You know, you start spinning off on the basis of self into areas that don't make any sense unless there's a self. For example, you think, what happens after I die? You know, what happens to myself after I die? Mm-hmm. You know, you can either think it disappears, or you can think it goes on and goes to heaven or hell, or, you know, you have all kinds of theories. But those theories only make sense if you believe in this, that this package that you've created in your mind called self is actually a real thing. And all the Buddhists are saying is it's just a package you've made in your mind. It's you're taking the stuff of experience and then drawing a kind of arbitrary circle around a certain group of things and saying, okay, that's self and that's me. But if you start examining that closely, it falls apart, which is, you know, it's one of the reasons people, there's this whole mindfulness movement that everybody loves and shares all sorts of stuff on Facebook about, and it's beautiful. But one of the problems with it is that if you start examining you start doing those practices to examine yourself closely, you find that your concept of self will start to dissolve, and people who are not philosophically or otherwise prepared for that will kind of freak out. Mm-hmm. And that this is causing some problems these days.
I tend to like, you know, I do a lot of exploring, and I tend to like Ramana Maharshi. This is an Indian fellow, as you probably know, and his thing is, "Who am I?" That's his mantra, and I find when I use that, it drops off so much attachment to whatever defines me, if that makes sense. And that's part of what I was reading into this. Yeah.
Yeah, I like Ramana Maharshi. I haven't read a lot of his stuff, but the bits and pieces I've read sound almost Zen-like, although he doesn't have any connection to the Zen tradition, but it's a real similar way of looking at things, which is to question the very nature of self and say, who am I? It's mm-hmm. one of those, often the Buddhist groups who use koans as a meditational tool will use that as a koan. So you're constantly asking yourself, who am I? And the tricky part is the more you ask it, the harder it becomes to answer. So you have no idea who you are at all. But
I think
at the same
time,
you have an idea, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm only doing it a little lately and some of the time, but I find it takes me into a very peaceful place where I'm not so attached to whether I've screwed up or whether I'm ambitious or blah, blah, blah. It doesn't mean I'm not going to carry on with my work. So I kind of was enjoying that part of your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no reason to get hung up on all that stuff. It's kind of, yeah, that idea of attachment is one of those that bugs people about Zen. You know, I used to get I haven't gotten them for a couple of years because I think maybe because I wrote a big part of a book about it. But I used to get these emails, which would be, you know, how do I deal with this attachment thing? Because I love my children or I love my husband or whatever people will say. And I'll be, no, that's not what we're talking about with, you know, non-attachment. We're not talking about giving up those important things in your life. It's just you have a fixed, you know, attachment means a fixed idea about how things must be, mm-hmm. you know, and how I must be.
Or is it related to how you, for example, a mother with two children, she's the mother. Is it sort of related to moving that title and that identity aside and deepening, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, you can be a mother, but you also realize that you are a lot of other things. I think anybody who's a mother must know that. But we kind of lose that in we get out of that situation and into a kind of sometimes a spiritual tradition and forget the things that we already know real well, which is that we're millions of things all at once, and you just kind of have to flow into each one as the situation dictates.
Isn't that interesting, hey? I mean, these things make me think for a long time, so I go blank. I'm sorry, I go into this deep place. But that's a good thing. So how does Dogen teach studying the self, or did he speak of that?
Well, yeah, he does. I mean, he has this really famous line that people love to quote, which is, to study the self is to forget the self and to be experienced by the millions of things, you know, in the universe. So
I have my finger on that line right now.
You can probably say it better than I can.
No, I like your paraphrasing. It's wonderful. But I also talk about that, the zillions of things. Talk about what that really means.
Well, we kind of go through life imagining that we are a single unit experiencing the world, and that's you know, usually a useful way to go through life, but we forget that there's this other side, which is that we are also one of the things being experienced by the world. So Buddhist philosophy gets a little weird and freaky in that it is a philosophy that believes that the entire universe is alive in a way. So even if you're in an empty room with no pets or bugs or anything, you're still being experienced by that room. And when you let go of this individual sense of I am at the center of things, experiencing them, you can kind of get a little bit of a glimpse of how you are also the object of experience at the same time as being the thing that experiences objects. So it becomes this more inclusive kind of sense of who you are that ultimately includes everything, which is, you know, where it gets kind of freaky.
I think that's really freaky. I think, okay, so my feeling, these things are a little hard to grasp all the time, Brad.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm often fascinated by, if you see someone a certain way, they're actually influenced to a degree by you seeing them that way, even if you're not speaking. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
So
it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we influence the world in subtle ways that we're not even aware of, that maybe we should be a little more careful about, if not, you know, neurotically careful about it. But I think if you work with this philosophy a lot, you get a less judgmental about things and people and a bit more accepting, because it's just everybody's kind of in the same boat trying to figure stuff out and deal with it. And once you kind of notice that, it's easy to be more forgiving of people, you know, which is at the same time, you don't have to be stupid. There's some people who do things that are completely unacceptable, and you have to kind of sometimes take a stand against it, but you can also accept that they're just trying to figure this stuff out too.
Well, what is healing? Big question.
I don't know. I don't tend to think too much in terms of healing, but I guess it's we kind of move through this world and get bumped and beaten up by it, and you just try to kind of make your way through, and I suppose healing is anything that tries to take that and make it a little bit easier, make the process of getting better a little easier. So I think we all have a duty to help each other get through, and how that duty manifests itself, it varies from person to person. So it's not always beautiful.
It has a kind of an underpinning of respect, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think you need to respect everybody you come in contact with, even when you don't respect them. I don't know. I mean, there are certain things. I always go to the darker edges. So I think, do I respect a neo-Nazi? And so I would have to respect the neo-Nazi as a person, as a human being, even though I can't respect what he's doing with his life and the kind of action that he's undertaking. That to me is a wrong way of dealing with the problems and frustrations of life, and there's a better way. But still, as a human being, you have to respect that they're just trying to get through this thing too. So they're taking this particular attitude, which is unhealthy for them and for the rest of us. So, it becomes a kind of a juggling act, I suppose.
Well, I think it's really interesting to bring that up, because you mentioned politics earlier, and I'm going, I'm thinking a lot of what you're writing here, or what Dogen says, and how to see the collective in function. And that's why I asked you about healing, because I thought, well, can we see one another respecting one another to improve conditions on this planet? And you picked a group that is not wanting to improve conditions. They're wanting to be mad at them or get even with them or punish them or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting aspect to all of that, in that if you press hard enough, most people have, even the worst human beings in the world, have as part of their philosophy an idea of helping, that... I think the Nazis in Germany were only as successful as they were because there was a lot of rhetoric about how they were taking these actions in order to make a better world. So if people didn't have some kind of belief that they were doing this to make a better world, it's really hard to get behind it. But it also gives you an excuse to be vengeful and to vent your hatred and anger. So you find this weird philosophical justification in which you say that you're gonna improve the world by bashing some heads, which is never really a good way to improve the world. It gets very tricky, but I think understanding that is helpful, because we've grown up with too much of this sort of cartoon villain aspect of where we just see everybody as, Dr. Evil up there going, I'm going to, do bad and whatever. And I don't think those people really exist, or if they do, they're not really significant.
They may be behind the scenes, right? Which brings me to the chapter called Stop Trying to Grab My Mind. isn't that what we're talking about as well? People grab one another's minds and move in certain directions collectively to take charge or to get even or vengeful or whatever.
Well, a little bit. In that particular chapter is this idea of mind cannot be grasped, which is this philosophical notion that you really never understand even your own mind, which I think is a good sort of thing to kind of sober people up by calling attention to the fact that even not only do you not know the minds of other people, but you don't even really know your own mind when it comes down to it. So
what is the mind?
Well, it's in a way unknowable. I mean, there's a lot of philosophy about the mind in Buddhism, and there's one in particular called Yogacara philosophy that takes as its position that everything is mind only, which makes people think, "Whoa, I'm just imagining all this world." But that's not really what they're saying. They're saying that everything that we encounter has this quality of mind to it. You know, I think if you grow up in the West these days, we have this kind of philosophical outlook that says only human beings have minds. You know, there are even people who will deny that animals have a mind, but I think that's kind of fading away. But we're willing now to accept that animals have minds, but we're not willing to accept that trees have minds or that rocks have a mind or that, you know, all of this. That sounds like metaphysics or something bizarre. But in Buddhism, there's this idea that mind is an aspect of everything that we encounter, which gets really weird, you know, and all I can tell you.
It reminds me of Frank Zappa singing "Help, I'm a Rock." Do you remember that?
I love that song. Yeah, Zappa was an interesting character in that he supposedly was a student of Zen, but never publicized it. Now, I've heard this rumor a couple of different places, and I've never been able to track down whether there's any real truth behind it.
Well, even though he was cheeky about it, he did include that, the green and yellow buddies worshiping together. I mean, he had a lot about rocks and animals and plants being intelligent, remember? but it was fun.
Yeah, and this and that idea is interesting. There was people were sharing this article on Facebook last week about how Buddhism proves that everything has consciousness, and I reacted against that because I think consciousness is just one of these funny ideas that we hit around to each other without really examining what it means.
I like what you're saying. That makes sense. Yeah, what does it mean to you?
Well, consciousness is sort of, I had this one moment with my teacher years ago in which some guy started telling him about consciousness, this and that, and he said, "Consciousness is just an idea." And I was just like, "Whoa, what is that? You know, how can you say consciousness is just an idea?" But it is just an idea. I mean, we have an idea, and we call that idea consciousness, and then we try to apply that idea to things. And it works in some places, and it doesn't work in others. But
I think it has an innate calibrating tool somewhere that people run it up and down a meter of some sort.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's scientists who are actually working on trying to define consciousness in that way as something that would actually make needles move on machines, you know, and they're trying to prove it that way. But I think it's a bit, that's not exactly what Buddhists are talking about when they talk about mind.
Mm.
You know, this idea of mind isn't that rocks think. But it's this idea that what we experience a certain aspect of nature as thinking. You know, we say, "Oh, we're having consciousness, you and I and all the people listening to this are sort of conscious of it." And there's a kind of a consciousness that exists even with what we call inanimate objects, but you can't use the word consciousness for it anymore because it becomes absurd, because then you start saying, "Well, if they have consciousness, then they must have an opinion, and you know, and all this other stuff." And I don't think rocks have an opinion about anything, but they have a kind of, in another sense, there's a mind aspect to even something like a rock.
But what mind is a little differently described in that part of the glossary. Tell me, what's a sutra?
What's a sutra?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in just prosaic or ordinary terms, a sutra is just anything the Buddha said becomes a sutra. But then, you know, it's one of these ancient Indian words describing a philosophical, religious piece of writing. But, you know, in another sense, Dogen talks about how objects in nature will proclaim the sutras. You know, there's a passage that I used in the book where he talks about how the sound of a stream contains sutras.
Oh.
And, yeah, and that's a really weird idea because we usually think of the sound of a stream as being a sort of just a noise, you know, that we can either enjoy or forget about, but we don't really learn anything from it. Dogen kind of takes the opposite view that if you actually listen to the sound of a stream, you can learn a kind of truth from it. And the truth is, that truth is kind of, we don't have human words for it, but the stream proclaims the truth in its own sort of stream language, which sounds very poetic and pretty, I guess. And I like it.
Well, I think it's very interesting, and I've heard people say, and I've heard it myself, you're listening to a stream and you hear words, you hear information of some sort, right?
It's some kind of information. You hear it, and if you kind of allow it to speak in its own language, you can feel something from it. Not necessarily in terms of being able to translate that into anything a human language is capable of expressing. But
you can call that a sutra? I mean...
Yeah, well, Dogen does. Dogen, in his in that particular essay, talks about how the stream proclaims sutras all night long, which is interesting. You know, I relate in the book a kind of experience I had of that, of kind of perceiving that for a brief period, and reflecting back on it, all you have is a kind of memory of it, which becomes very muddled and very difficult to express. But at the time, you can kind of feel that, oh yeah, that makes sense. Now I know what that means when he said the stream is proclaiming sutras. You can kind of hear it for yourself.
I get that. So now we have to end this shortly, and I really hate to let you go because I want to, I guess I'll just have to do some more studying and maybe you can guide me. But what, do you have something final to say to the listeners? Like, are you going to be writing more books, and are you coming to a sort of a, what is it? Not conclusion. Do you really love this study you're doing, and is it just the beginning for you? I always have a theory that the stuff I love is always at the beginning because I just never want to stop learning it, sort of thing.
Well, I think so, yeah. And Dogen, I've read Dogen on and off for about 30 years. It's only been in the last, the first 10 years I probably wasn't as serious as I became later. But so I've been reading this stuff that he wrote for a long time, and actually sitting down at a table with every translation of Shobo Genzo I could get a hold of and the Japanese original and stuff, which is what I did to come up with this book, was really interesting because I got to go through his work often word by word to try to decipher it and try to... You know, I had a good teacher who I think produced one of the best translations of Shobo Genzo into English that really exists at this point. And even so, reading that alone isn't enough to get you really deeply into it. When you really start to work with it, you go... I mean, there were so many parts where I would take, I don't know, 5 or 7 different translations of a single line and go, oh, I see. Everybody is just guessing what this line means. You know.
But is it your digestion that calls or distills what it is it means to you?
Well, yeah, and you have a kind of a grounding in the teaching, which will help you interpret it. But sometimes Dogen, most of the time, I feel like Dogen is pretty straightforward. But there are occasions where he gets so weird that we're all just guessing what the heck he meant. You know.
And I have to say goodbye. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you, Brad Warner, and you've taught us not to be a jerk in your latest book. And this is Veronica, and thank you so much for listening to Paradigm Shifters. For more information, you can get in touch with me, veronicaentwistle.com. And I'm sure, Brad, would you like to give your email?
Well, my website is hardcorezen.info, and that's the best place to find me. So it's hardcorezen, like one word, and .info. That's got all my blogs and books, and it's got a place where you can email me if you want. So it's all there.
Thank you so much for the time with you. It's been very illuminating. Thank you so much,
Brad. Thank you.